all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We're very excited today to have a veteran advocate and activist with us on Veterans Radio. Our guest today is Sue Frazier. Sue, say hello to the Veterans Radio listening audience.
Hello, veterans, and thank you for your service.
Well, it's great to help get you the story out on Fort McClellan and the veterans who passed through there and some of the exposures that they had, as even though they didn't know they were having those exposures while they were stationed at Fort McClellan. Sue, let's start with give us the thumbnail, if you will, for those who aren't familiar with Fort McClellan, which is now closed down in Alabama. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was started during the tail end of World War II. It really did not flourish until the 1950s during the Korean War era. It ended in the year 1998. During that time, it became the National Boot Camp Training Center for the former Women's Army Corps, which was decommissioned in the Army in 1978, about, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so before the base itself was closed. It was also the home base for the U.S. Army Chemical Corps School and the U.S. Army Military Police School.
Well, it is, these dates, listeners, are important because as we go through this story, you're going to ask yourself, geez, did I go through through Fort McClellan at a time where I could have been exposed, or did my uncle or aunt or somebody? So, again, it was closed in the late 1990s, but most active, as Sue Frazier tells us, from about 1951 through the mid to late 70s when the Chemical Corps and the Women's Army Corps were there. I think the Army Military Police School was there a little longer. But, Sue, where is Fort McClellan?
It's about 5 miles outside of town of Anniston, Alabama.
And, Sue, I understand that you actually were stationed at Fort McClellan, or Fort Mac, as it's known by some, for a period of time.
Yes. I was there in the year 1970. A lot of people came back there multiple times to take various kinds of schooling that was available for the Women's Army Corps during those years. There were several other schools in, to do with rank, such as the Officers Candidate School and the NCO Academy, as well as MOS-type schools, such as the Women's Clerical Training School for MOSs and clerical training.
And you mentioned earlier that actually that Fort McClellan, before that I guess it was Camp McClellan, has a long history in the Army going back to the World War I period of time. How is it that it came about to be closed in the late 1990s?
I'm not sure what the cause was, other than I can tell you from reviewing the base newspapers collection, which is found in an archives at the Anniston Public Library to this very day, tells a story that they were looking at closing the base for perhaps as long as the early 1970s. There were different articles that came up in the base newspaper about troop reduction and phasing out different buildings, different classes, different things that were coming up on the base. Entire sweeps and populations of people and coursework and buildings and all that were getting phased out and not replaced. And so incrementally, these trends had been popping up all through the 70s and all through the 80s until there was a final declaration by BRAC, which is the Base Realignment and Closing Commission, to finally close the base as a national federal army training center.
Well, I think all the folks listening to Veterans Radio and listeners, we're talking to Sue Frazier, who's a activist on this issue of Fort McClellan toxic exposure. We all know about BRAC and that basic closure and realignment process, and without it, nothing would probably ever close in the federal system. And I saw some, in my readings, I saw that Fort McClellan made it on the BRAC list almost year after year after year, but the politicians in Alabama did a pretty good job of keeping it alive, sometimes at a very low level, but keeping it alive until it ultimately closed, I guess, in about 1999. So that's the history, folks, of Fort McClellan from the early World War One period, build up after in the 1950s through the 1970s, and ultimate closure in about 1999. Now, Sue, tell us a little bit about when you joined the Army and what your military career was like and those sorts of things.
Well, I came through Fort McClellan in 1970. I went through boot camp in June. I graduated from that, and I was transferred to the other side of the base, where I entered the 14th Army Military Marching Band of the Women's Army Corps. I was stationed there permanent duty for only a few months, and then I signed up for Signal Corps School in Augusta, Georgia, U.S. Army Signal Corps School. And I left Fort McClellan around November of 1970. I attended the 3 month course at Signal Corps School, graduated from there, and I was shipped out again for permanent duty at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And it just seemed to me that from the time that I left Fort McClellan to the time I landed at Fort Rucker, which is down at the southern borderline of between Alabama and Florida, I had a developing trail of different medical things that were taking me over one thing at a time. So in 1972, I discharged out. I was in poor health at that time, and within about 90 days of that discharge, I entered the VA medical care system.
And one of the things I want our listeners to understand is that Fort McClellan toxic exposure is somewhat unique. We'll talk about some of these other exposures, but one of the unique things about Fort McClellan, Sue, maybe you can tell us a little bit about who the neighbors were in Anniston, Alabama.
Well, Fort McClellan owned and operated other satellite properties, one of which was known as Pelham Range, which was a massive artillery tank range. There was a second property owned called Anniston Army Depot. Both of those properties are still there to this very day, but they are owned and operated by other management. And then in between those two properties was a civilian-owned chemical solution factory known as the Monsanto PCB Industrial Factory.
And what types of products did Monsanto make at the Anniston plant?
The technical name for it is called Aerochlor, A-R-O-C-L-O-R, Aerochlor PCBs. And they were used for industrial manufacturing purposes, and they were created at Monsanto and then sold to other corporations, such as General Electric Company, to be remanufactured again into other products. That's the best way I can tell it to you. These PCB products, Aerochlor, were poisonous.
And this plant was essentially across the street. It was the largest industrial plant, I believe, in Anniston, Alabama, and kind of the biggest neighbor of Fort McClellan, if I understand it right.
Yes. Yes, it was one of the top employers of the entire region. And military veterans who decided to stay in the area after they discharged from Fort McClellan very often got jobs at Monsanto.
Now, that may be a name that rings a little bell for some of our listeners, because Anniston, Alabama, and the Monsanto plant, they got a lot of publicity a number of years back when the CBS show 60 Minutes did a program on Monsanto and what it did in Anniston. Isn't that right?
Yes, it made national headline news, and of course, that is how we came by the information that anything environmental at all was even brewing in the area, in that regional area. This is what caught our attention initially, was the Monsanto spill, which led us down the trail to look even further into issues of Fort McClellan.
And before we go deeper into the types of contamination at Fort McClellan, I guess I want to set the stage for our veteran radio listeners, in that our government and our military services have a sort of a checkered past on some of these toxic exposures. And I know these aren't necessarily your area that you focus on, but maybe you want to talk about either the acknowledgement that Agent Orange was used outside of Vietnam, or the Brownwater Navy guys who got exposed, or the C-123 air crews that got exposed, or now the most recent, the Camp Lejeune folks who got exposed. There's sort of a thread here that ties all the way to Fort McClellan, don't you think? I guess my question, Sue, is in terms of the types of exposures at Fort McClellan, I think you've identified that there were three or four sort of main types of toxic exposures.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about what those are?
Well, it's our causation list is divided into three sites. One is the grounds and airspace of Fort McClellan. The second is the satellite properties of Fort McClellan, which is Pelham Range and Anniston Army Depot. And the third are properties or airspace outside of Fort McClellan and their properties, which would be downtown Anniston and down into the Oxford, Alabama area, which is on the other side of town of Anniston, in the opposite direction from Fort McClellan.
And in those different locations, was there exposure to radioactive compounds?
At Pelham Range and on the grounds of Fort McClellan, there's a place called Rideout Airfield. There was two different locations found in 1998, which had somewhat secretive radiological burial mounds accumulating in these spaces that had not been previously known about. They were not roped off, they were not gated off, they were not signed off. And so far as we know, these were significant toxic sites requiring full EPA-mandated Superfund remediation cleanup, with people wearing hazmat suits coming in to take it all out.
And we, the history on the Fort McClellan tells us that the Army Combat Development Command for Chemical and Biological and Radiological Agency was stationed there at Fort McClellan. So were they using radioactive compounds in research and development or training activities? How did this stuff come to be located at the base?
Well, there was a couple of things at play with the Army Chemical School. One was your typical and usual functions of the school itself, what you would normally expect as a military program during that time. There was a second, more dubious group involved in all this, and this is where they create a blind spot for a lot of us across many of these different environmental reports, having to do with a group called the Edgewood Test Veterans, who were transplanted into the Army Chemical School without the knowledge of the command authority knowing about it. This all came to light many, many years later, who the Edgewood Test Veterans actually were. As for the burial mounds and the contamination sites, what we do know is it was cobalt lead rods that were left in the ground that were never known about, apparently by classes that were done in days gone by, where instructors either had failed to remove the cobalt lead rods or whatever. There was also open-air burn pits where chemical weapons were staged, and some of these Chemical Corps veterans have stated to me in emails, various emails, and even sent me pictures, where active chemical weapons would be activated in the open air on the grounds of Fort McClellan, and then it was up to the class to deactivate it in some kind of way. Whatever the process was for them to deactivate it, whether it was to flood it with some kind of foaming material or to get in there and mess around with devices, I'm not sure what all this was. I didn't really need to understand the details at this level. But in the pursuit of all these stagings, there was open air pits done that involved VX and sarin gas releases. And so we had two forces at play. One is known about, the Army Chemical Corps, and the other not so much known about, which is the Edgewood Test Veterans.
And if, help me out here, the Edgewood Test Veterans took part, about 7,000 or so soldiers took part in exposure experiments to different types of chemicals, and then what, were just sent into the general population at Fort McClellan just to see how they would react?
That's my understanding. There were different missions that were handed to them as a statement of purpose. And some of those had to do with testing of hazmat suits or hazmat facial masking. Some were flimsy, known to be flimsy when they put them on and use them. This was back in a time when the atomic veterans were actually asked to go into open-air ditches as a way of shielding themselves from atomic blast. So there was a lot of dubious things that come out of this Edgewood test scenario. We have not heard all the details from all of them yet. In terms of what they have said to the Vietnam Veterans of America, many of them were stationed at Fort McClellan TDY, or temporary duty. And what this does, what many people know about on active duty in the military world, is that TDY is not always documented very well in your service record. And that's what
that's what we find all the time working with veterans trying to get disability claims done is, yeah, I went TDY somewhere. Well, that means your records are never going to be found. Unfortunately, you're right. It's hard to track people in that situation. So let's talk about the chemical warfare agents. You mentioned sarin gas and VX. This is, I think, mustard gas was used on the site. Various nerve agents. This was all part of the chemical core schooling and how to deal with these sorts of things. Is that sort of how that was being used at the site?
Yes, we've had different stories told from the Fort McClellan veterans themselves that they were actually holding open-air classes from veterans, for other veterans who were coming down from Huntsville, Alabama, at the Redstone Army Arsenal, I think it is, to show them how to switch canisters of both VX and mustard gas and sarin and all this. And that would be to basically pop the valves on the top of the canisters and reconnect the valves on another canister, all of this while they were suited up. And this is part of the bystander scenario that we are packaging and trying to put together for our cause before the VA, is that the accumulation of all of these air releases going on, first at one place and then another and then another and then another. I mean, the story is just harrowing down there when you look at all the papers. That along the way, this took a toll on the health of all of the veterans, both men and women, who were there.
And there are, I guess, two more exposures I want to mention because I see them in some of the public health disclosures by VA. One is, we mentioned briefly the Monsanto plant, which was nearby, but maybe you can talk about airborne PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls that veterans or at that time service members at Fort McClellan may have been exposed to.
Well, the Monsanto spill went on for many, many years, first before any authorities knew about it, and then it went on for many years long after authorities knew about it. The spill is regional wide. It is massive. It runs from the midtown of Anniston, Alabama, all the way down into Oxford, Alabama, which is on the other side of town. It came out in three different pathways. There was a pathway for groundwater and nearby stream water. There was also a pathway for soil for the property owners who owned homes and all that all along the water route. And then there were broken, verified broken air stacks at the factory that culminated in air releases of PCBs, raw PCBs into the air. And the primary chemistry compound of PCBs is the metallic compound called lead. So this lead particulate all remained in the cloud cover for many years after these releases. And it is the air side of this spill that we are trying to have looked at and examined very closely in the context of military veterans who traveled all up and down throughout that regional area.
Well, and that exposure happened not only to folks at Fort McClellan, but also people in Anniston and surrounding areas. And Monsanto ultimately acknowledged, well, they probably legally didn't acknowledge any responsibility, but they ultimately settled with the folks in and around Alliston, Alabama, with a multi-million, hundreds of millions of dollars settlement, did they not?
Yes. The property owners especially were the primary litigants for class action there in Anniston, Alabama. Our awareness about this came in at the very end of all the class action lawsuits that were spawning out of this for the water and the soil part of the spill. In the end of everything, we were locked out of all the processes.
So the veterans saw no compensation for their toxic exposure as a result of that settlement?
No. We were refused at every turn. We were refused assistance at all the agencies, including the Environmental Protection Agency, the ATSDR agency in Atlanta, which is Region 4, and with the Anniston PCB Consortium, which was located at Jacksonville University, just north of Fort McClellan.
And then one more toxic exposure I want to mention before we get to the break. You sent me some information about asbestos at the site. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
We found that several barracks buildings, residential barracks buildings on Fort McClellan, had asbestos readings in those buildings that were registering at toxic levels. And in terms of trying to match those buildings up to units, we found that it affected the former Women's Army Corps up until the year 1975. During that time, they moved the entire WAC battalion over to a set of new buildings. And when they did that, they moved enlisted men into the same exact contaminated buildings. And so that was one scenario where both, where we could put a name to both the men and the women occupying the very same exact set of buildings right when it was known that they had asbestos toxic readings. to this minute, none of this has been made publicly known to the veterans. There was no notification plan in place for this. And what we found out in the environmental reports that were done by BRAC, that asbestos in the buildings is not normally covered by remediation cleanup at EPA. They do not include it on the CERCLA database as a Superfund site.
So we've had solid science and facts indicating that service members stationed at Fort McClellan in Alabama were exposed to quite a variety of toxic matters, from radioactive compounds to chemical warfare agents to airborne PCBs to asbestos to things in the groundwater like TCE, things like VX and sarin gas. After the break, we'll come back and talk to Sue Frazier, our Army veteran who was stationed at Fort McClellan.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Fawson. We're talking on veterans radio.net.
We'll talk some more about Sue Frazier,
what's being done,
who is a veteran activist,
veterans
trying to get the word out about toxic exposure at Fort McClellan, and we'll be right
in
back.
In Alabama, that base was closed by BRAC in about 1999. But during the 50s through the 70s,
was a highly used Army base where the Women's Army Corps, the Army Military Police School, various Chemical Corps schools, and others were held. And those veterans, Sue has told us, may well have been exposed to such things as radiological and nuclear waste, asbestos, PCBs, chemical warfare agents like nerve gas, mustard gas, VX, sarin, and a whole soup of toxic exposure. Sue, as this word has developed and sort of gotten out, how long has the Fort McClellan group of veterans been trying to advance their cause that they ought to be looked at more closely by VA?
Well, my first organized talk before a panel of staffers at the House Veterans Affairs Committee took place by me in the year 2003. And all this time later, we are still haggling with process, haggling with agencies, and haggling with systems and political parties to try to get something mobilized on behalf of these very sick veterans.
How does VA treat veterans who can't have documented time at Fort McClellan? Do they get any special acknowledgement, treatment, scrutiny?
From what we can tell right now, if they claim to be a toxic exposure veterans case from Fort McClellan, the door is basically slammed in their face. There is no outreach at all done to them by the VA. Their cases are wholesale denied in most cases. The burden is put on one veteran at a time to come up with a massive cache of papers that we have collected for the group level to use at the national meetings at VA in Washington, D.C. This is way too much of a burden for one person to take on. Many of these veterans now have significant respiratory disease, such as COPD, or they have cancers and tumors or recurring cancers. Cancers that come and go, they're in remission, then they're not, it's back again, now it's in remission again, that kind of thing. This has taken its toll on all of our people, and physically they just can't endure the process.
So it seems that in the early years, and unfortunately we're now talking a dozen years later, but in the early 2000s, there was some momentum for at least a registry. Hey, who went through Fort McClellan? Let's start there. That type of registry was certainly used for atomic veterans and others. Tell us a little bit about the progress or lack thereof of getting a registry started.
I believe the first version of the legislative bill that was submitted in our name in the Congress was right around the year 2010. We went through a lot of different obstacles inside the Congress. We were known to the staffers at the House Veterans Affairs Committee for a very long time. We had worked with all of them in developing our cause, figuring out what we needed for papers, figured out what we needed to say or respond to for legislative language, what to ask for, what not to ask for, what to leave in, what to leave out, and all this kind of thing. Our legislation bill came out under two or three different numbers, and it ended last year in the year 2014. And it ended something like this. We had 85 national co-sponsors in place. What that means is 85 other different congresspersons, men and women alike, who had Fort McClellan veterans in their home states who had made themselves known to those congressional offices had all signed up as co-sponsors for our legislation bill. The end of that was that Chairman Jeff Miller of the House Veterans Affairs Committee refused to process the bill. He refused to have any public hearings on Fort McClellan and would not hold even so much as a single meeting to discuss, evaluate, or process the bill, which at that time was under bill number H.R. 411. To this minute, we don't know what to make of all that, other than to say that what we do know in the Republican Party is that Congressman Mike Rogers of Anniston, Alabama, has consistently refused and denied the claims of veterans from Fort McClellan. And because both Jeff Miller and Mike Rogers sits on the House Armed Services Committee, we feel that some kind of collusion has gone on there between these two men to hold back or hold down the cause of these military veterans.
And this isn't a small group of veterans. What's your estimate of how many men and women, family members, passed through this area of Alabama during the operations of the base?
The Women's Army Corps Veterans Association does keep track of our death rate for the WACs, and that, along with other statistical data that was available to us during the time that we were processing in the Congress, trying to get co-sponsors and all that. Our best population estimate right now is 110,000 military veterans affected who are still surviving right now.
Is the efforts to create the registry dead at this point, or will H.R. 411 be picked up and carried over into the new Congress?
The original bill sponsor for H.R. 411 has tried to resubmit an adapted version of the bill that we were fronting at the time. Since that time, since the beginning of this year, we began a series of face-to-face meetings at the VA. This is at the VA post-9/11 Deployment and Environmental Health Office. What opened that process up to us was the change in the VA secretary. VA Secretary Robert McDonald made it possible for us to start having a series of review meetings at the VA in Washington, D.C. So we moved our effort from the Congress over to the VA agency, which is where all the discussions and the talks are going on right now, for what it's worth.
Well, and you've had some success at the VA in that they finally hosted a public health, I don't know if you call it an announcement or an advisory or an informational page about Fort McClellan. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the page was something that I had asked for in our meeting of February, I think it was February 18th of this year. They had asked if there was anything they could do to help. And I said, yes, you could help us with notification to the veterans. We need a notification plan to these veterans that there was multiple environmental hazards down there. And they said, well, we'll look into it, we'll consider it, and look at it. So a few months went by, and the webpage did come up. We've had a couple of more meetings since then. It's been my understanding that this webpage is fully revisable, and that the meetings and the discussions and the exchange of papers would all continue, and that the webpage would be revised accordingly to accurately and truthfully show what our cause and our story is. This has turned out to be not the case. we've had a change of personnel. Dr. Carolyn Clancy has left. Dr. David Shulkin has come in. We are seeing a shift and a change in the whole VA environment. They're going back to their whole standoff, lockout, damn the torpedoes type mentality that they were stuck in before Dr. Clancy came in. We don't know what to make of the VA's refusal to revise and update our webpage. All I know is the way it is right now, it's not truthful, it's not accurate, and it's not really serving our veterans very well.
Well, I suppose it's something, and I want to point our veteran radio listeners to that page. We'll talk some more later about how you can get in touch with Sue Frazier, the veteran advocate we're talking to. She's an activist for veterans who have had toxic exposure at Fort McClellan, Alabama. But the current page that's up for VA is at www.publichealth.va.gov/exposures/Fort-McClellan, MCCLELLAN. And at least there's an admission that there were some potential exposures, but as we've talked already on this program, Sue, it doesn't look like they're listing all of them, does it?
No. In one case, they are listing the ATSDR report, which is something we never handed to them. What we gave to them was an EPA report that showed the actual barrel count and tonnage of releases into the air from the Monsanto factory. The ATSDR report that they have posted on their web page shows no such barrel count at all. So if you were looking at the web page, you would not know that we actually know the small measurement details of how much was released from Monsanto into the air during the 1970s.
Well, I also think it's something we haven't touched on, and maybe we can clear this up or be a little more clear on it, Sue Frazier, veteran activist regarding toxic exposure at Fort McClellan. The whole site, essentially, has been identified by the United States Environmental Protection Agency as a Superfund site that needs some specific cleanups at various landfill dumps and other things. Maybe you can talk about that and how that's just sort of a treasure trove of information.
Well, the challenges we are putting onto the system right now, whether it's the VA or the Army or anyone else, is a challenge of circumstances. And the circumstances go something like this. Most of the incremental environmental reports that were coming out of Fort McClellan, Alabama, up until the BRAC report of 1998, were all showing very low dose, low measurement, low ball readings for toxicity and measurements in various air, soil, and water samplings. But then when we get to the 1998 baseline survey, when the BRAC is announcing the closing of the properties of Fort McClellan, now this is a game changer. All of a sudden, EPA Superfund CERCLA level database remediation cleanup projects are all initialized and mobilized, not only on Fort McClellan, but at Pelham Range, and then again at Anniston Army Depot. Here they all come in their hazmat suits. At Pelham Range, they were so concerned about pollution and contamination that they commissioned an aerial aviation engineering company to do air sampling while they were removing the radiological burial mound at Pelham Range. And yet they do all this, and it never occurs to anybody, hey, wait a minute, what about the veterans?
And Sue, is that cleanup at Fort McClellan being paid for by the government? Who's paying for all that, and why couldn't they have put some dollars into it to help address these issues for the veterans?
Well, the funding is public taxpayer money, and it would have had to have been authorized or paid for or mobilized or justified by the various congressmen and the senators of Anniston, Alabama, which would include Congressman Mike Rogers. As for the treatment or reach out to the veterans, it was their collective position that not at any time, not at any place, and not at any reason, for whatever thought you could imagine, was a single military veteran exposed to anything at all at Fort McClellan or in downtown Anniston, even though civilians were, even though hazmat suits had to be worn for the cleanup and all this other hoo-ha in the report. Not for any reason were any of the veterans mentioned, even not even a mention. We're talking 35,000 troops on an Army base, and not even a mention to them about their health risk in any of these reports. We really do take issue with that.
I can certainly hear the frustration in your voice as well as one of those troops who was so exposed. Let's make this clear to our Veterans Radio listeners. The problem here is you've had these exposures at different levels of all sorts of things, and subsequently you have health problems as a veteran. The burden's on you to prove that your health problem is related to these exposures, and establishing that medical nexus in such a complicated situation is almost impossible, isn't it?
Yes, it is, according to the way they have it right now. And the way they have it right now is very obsolete. It's a poor plan. It used to work back in its day, but it's not so good anymore. And it definitely explodes upon impact when you try to put this Fort McClellan scenario to the whole thing.
So why don't you give us your views a little bit over these dozen years or so that you've been working on this. Many of our listeners would be familiar with presumptive illnesses like Agent Orange. If you've been exposed to Agent Orange, there's certain presumptions that if you have this disease, it's related to the exposure. Give us your views on how that would work or not work at Fort McClellan in Anniston, Alabama.
Well, at the VA, they have a toxic exposure review process called presumption. It's not written very well. It's not documented very well. It happens to be whatever they make up at the moment when you sit in a meeting. It's all dispersed through one person at a time, evidencing right now by VA claims raters who sit at the VA regional offices who are non-medical people. Not one of them are qualified as doctors, and yet they're trying to pass this off through a system of claims where non-medical raters are used. The evidencing very often relies on time-limited, perfect world evidencing, which is imposed by case precedents. It's not written anywhere. It's whatever they were able to pass off and impose on groups before you, so this gets carried over into your face to apply to your group as an evidencing standard. What presumption does, essentially, whether anybody understands this or not, I'm going to tell it to you because this is exactly what the VA is doing to us. It alters the reasonable doubt legal evidencing standard for claims for veterans, and it alters it in such a way that the proofing can almost never be met. One of the things they like to use is something called PPM blood serum tests. And these PPM blood serum tests have an expiration date on them, depending on what the toxic exposure source is. They're all different for different kinds of things. We went in and looked for the PPM rate of elimination for PCBs, for instance, and that runs about 6 or 7 years that it stays in the blood where it's actually measurable in the blood. Well, in order to get those PPM blood serums active and read from a veteran, that veteran would have to come out of the Anniston PCB zone, have a really high contact level, either with soil or water, just about wash their hands in it in order to get a blood reading on it. and then turn around and immediately go to a VA hospital and get their blood test drawn so they could capture that reading. This is the kind of nonsense that's going on with the VA right now. And then the raters, who are non-medical people, all this time later are trying to force these veterans who haven't even been at Fort McCullen for up to 20 years or so, trying to force them to go out and get a PPM blood test.
Well, it's certainly clear that if the VA doesn't recognize that there was toxic exposure at Fort McCullen, the individual veteran will have a very difficult, if not impossible, time tying back his or her medical condition today to that time at the base 30 or 40 years ago. And I think that's our country owes our veterans better than that.
Well, our reply to all this has been to try to advance a Plan B idea of grouping up the Fort McCullen service veterans and matching them up by common medical conditions, not only to the VASR-D, which is the codified disability tables at the VA, but also to match them up to the posted health risk profiles, which are on the websites at the EPA and the CDC.
Well, I think we're coming up against our time here, Sue. I want to, this has been a very interesting discussion. We haven't even gotten into chromosomal changes and miscarriage problems women are having, and if TCE in the groundwater at Camp Lejeune is a problem, why isn't TCE in the groundwater at Fort McCullen a problem? And if dioxins in Agent Orange are a problem, why aren't PCBs in Anniston a problem? So we probably could have this discussion for another hour or so, but we're coming to the end. How do people interested in this issue stay in contact on this issue, follow what you're doing, and support what you're doing?
We do have a Facebook group page where I post news stories and any other incremental meeting reports that I have in Washington, or any outcomes of emails or conversations that I have with the system right now. The name of that Facebook group page is called Fort McCullen PCB Medical Veterans. And my email is stakeholders_activists@yahoo.com.
So they can keep in touch with you either by going and getting involved in the Facebook group page, Fort McCullen PCB Medical
Veteran.
I can't even read my own notes. I'm writing so fast. Well, it's interesting. I'm trying to keep up with you. Or your email address, Sue, say that again.
It's stakeholders with an S, activist@yahoo.com.
And I know this is a mission that you have found yourself on. Certainly, we can tell from this interview how involved you are, how passionate you are to try to set this right. I hope that you have a good group of people around you supporting this mission, because it's certainly worthwhile.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so Veterans Radio listeners, we've been talking to Sue Frazier, an Army veteran. She herself went through Fort McCullen, had some toxic exposure and resulting poor health, which she attributes to it. She has for the last dozen years or more been on the mission of getting the word out through the Congress, through the VA, about the problems that veterans are finding, health problems because of that toxic exposure. We're glad to have her on Veterans Radio. Thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook,
Listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. Until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.